And welcome to the Podluck, serving up bite-sized tastes of the best theology. I'm your host, Megan Westra. Grab a plate and let's dig in. All right, and we are back. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of the Podluck. As always, I'm your host, Megan Westra. Today, we are continuing on in our Corona Kegger series, this unique time that we're in and hearing from a variety of unique voices in the work that people are doing. And one of the things that is still very much happening, and that it's been a real joy to talk to a few people about, is that people are still releasing books, even in the middle of a pandemic. Thank goodness. So today I'm talking with yet another author who is releasing a book in the middle of this pandemic, Danielle Mayfield. So Danielle lives and writes on the outskirts of Portland, Oregon with her husband and two kids. Her first book is a book of essays, Assimilate or Go Home, Notes from a Failed Missionary or on Rediscovering Faith. And her second book released last week. It's called The Myth of the American Dream, Reflections on Affluence, Autonomy, Safety, and Power. Whew, just the title alone, y'all. And that book is out on InterVarsity Press. Her writing has also appeared in a variety of places, including Mick Sweeney's Christianity Today, Sojourners, The Washington Post, Image Journal, Vox, and The Rumpus, among many others. She is trying very hard to be a good neighbor. And so I have respected Danielle's work for a long time, all the many places that she writes. And also she has a podcast, which we talk a little bit about at the end, called the Prophetic Imagination Station, which is just the most glorious mashup of, kind of taking a critical eye to evangelical theology and also like 1990s evangelical church nostalgia. Like it's so just cringy and funny and exactly on like the wavelength that I love to hum on. So anyway, if that sounds like your cup of tea, then you should definitely go and subscribe to that podcast as well. So I was super fortunate to be able to have a chance to read Danielle's book already and then get to talk with her last week. Like I said, just a minute ago, the book is out now. It's been out for 1 week exactly as I'm recording this on Tuesday. This intro anyway on Tuesday. And so pick up a copy. You can order it through InterVarsity Press directly. You could place an order through Bookshop and help support a local bookstore. You could order it on Amazon. That's cool. There is an audiobook of it available as well. So if that's something you're into, then good news for you. But I'm going to roll tape on this because I had such a good time tagging with Danielle about her book and just life generally. And so I'm very excited for you to tune in to this conversation. So grab a plate. Let's dig in. So Danielle, I'm super excited to be talking with you today. Your book, The Myth of the American Dream, launched this week. And I adore it. I love it because it names all the things that are hard and true. And it is a conversation around the subtitle is Reflections on Affluence, Autonomy, Safety, and Power. So just the light things that everybody likes to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I like to talk about them. I think they're perfectly safe dinner table conversation. So I think just to help the listeners get oriented, to help us like open up this conversation, can you let's dig into those last two a little bit, like safety and power, which I think we're becoming very aware in this moment how much of a myth safety is and how maybe how we hold power is mythological. So can you help our listeners just get a little bit grounded in how you're holding these conversations, particularly with those last two? And let's set some things on fire. before we go?
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Just go straight to it. Well, first, I'm so happy to be here. You know, I think it's really interesting. This is the first time we're having a conversation because I follow you on Twitter and I just think you're so awesome. And I kind of already feel like we're friends. So it's great to be here. I wrote a book that has a very intense title, very intense subtitle, kind of some intense things in there. But I do want to clarify that I'm trying to write essays and I'm trying to write in such a way that is inviting people into start to question things, right? And so one of my like writing mantras is I want to be curious, right? And so I want to question things. And that's why it was really important to me to just start to think about values and how values shape your life if you come from the dominant culture of the United States. And that's me to a T, right? I'm white, evangelical. I was homeschooled. I'm a pastor's kid. Just layers upon layers, middle class. And it's really hard when you come from the dominant culture to start to understand what that means. And I think we've probably all been on journeys, right? Where we have experiences where we're like, whoa, I guess, whoa, people are different from me. And, you know, but if, you know, you can actually cushion your life in a way where you don't have to have that experience that often. Yeah. And so, you know, everybody's journey is different, but mine was really helped along by being in relationship with people who, had experienced forced migration and were trying to make a new life here in my city of Portland, Oregon. And through their eyes, I was able to be like, oh my gosh, America kind of sucks for people who aren't just like me. And then that kind of led to some questions like, is my religion good news for someone who's not exactly like me? And, you know, I have been living in community with immigrant refugee populations in the U.S. for about 14 years now. And I think the best thing about it is that I have just put myself in a situation where I can't wiggle out of my own privilege, right? And I just have to be like, this is the reality and this is it. And so a part of grappling with that is thinking through these values. And just through doing some like exploring with scripture passages, particularly where Jesus is talking about the kingdom of God and what the kingdom of God looks like and who's blessed in the kingdom of God, I just started to ask myself, like, what are the opposite of these blessed places that Jesus is talking about? And I was kind of surprised to be like, oh my gosh, it's like the pursuit of affluence and autonomy and safety and wellness and power. And just recognizing not only does like American culture tell me to pursue those things, but actually Christianity, Christianity had told me to pursue those things. And I was like, but this seems kind of at odds with Jesus. And, you know, it sounds so trite to say that, but when you've been raised to be a very good little Jesus follower, and then you realize, oh my gosh, I think I'm on the wrong pathway here. It creates a crisis point. I mean, I'm sure you've experienced that too. And I think
I don't know
we all have
about what you're talking about.
Right, exactly. And how do we just continue to allow ourselves to have that crisis? I guess, because you don't get to just have it once, right? And be done with it. So for me, really focusing on these values and how they've shaped my life and my imagination is sort of an entry point into me being like, huh, I wonder where the Holy Spirit is asking me to do something differently than how I've been conditioned. And so safety, when I wrote the safety section, I was really sort of focusing on, you know, an issue that's really dear to my heart, which is the death of the U.S. refugee resettlement program. I mean, under Trump's administration, it's been dismantled. Even if somehow by a miracle we were able to, you know, change the laws and we would allow refugees back into our country, you know, we don't have the infrastructure anymore because it's all been shut down to do that. And so I was really writing it from that perspective and how, you know, the conversation really has been one of, you know, there's people coming from other countries to take our jobs and to hurt our people and all this and how it's just so completely illogical, ridiculous. But now, you know, that conversation has kind of shifted, right, in light of COVID-19 and we're seeing some other ways this value of safety is playing out. And I would say, you know, safety, power, affluence, autonomy, really what I'm trying to do with this book is grapple with the reality that my Christian upbringing did not give me a framework for the common good. And it did not give me a way to live my life for the common good. And so like, I mean, I don't know if as I'm saying this, there anything pops up for you that you've been seeing like on social media about how people are unable to engage with this issue of safety and the common good. Does something come up for you?
Yes, possibly. one or two things. I think it's just, you know, I think the book is so profound in part because it does ring so true to my experience. And yeah, I mean, that's super early on in the book, like first couple pages where you do that. I looked at these values and like, who's blessed? And I just did the opposite of those. And I think I underlined that whole page because I was just like, oh, dang, that's it. Because I'm still a huge Bible nerd, right? At the end of the day, I still enormous, like, Awana champion Bible nerd kid, in a larger body now. And so, yeah, the idea of how do we not just have a framework for pursuing the common good, but how have we actively like resisted common good? Because it's really about you and your personal life, your personal salvation, your personal choices. And so like simple things like wear a mask. And no, not because it protects you, but because it protects other people. And the vehement resistance that that has, you know, on like just like a low level thing. But then I think things like conspiracy theories, denial of how serious this is. Well, you know, we have to accept a certain amount of death. Like, I mean, just pick anything, start anywhere. And there's so little regard for common good. And I think that's one of the things that's been most grievous to me, which made your book such a welcome companion right now. I'm just like, oh no, that there's a goodness in the grief of realizing, oh, we weren't prepared to handle, our faith didn't prepare us to handle something like this.
Yeah.
Which is just sad.
Yeah. But, and I think, you know, you're similar to me in that we are like grappling with the faith we were given in childhood. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think it's totally makes sense how that people deconstruct and walk away from it completely in it. And I honestly don't blame them for that, but I'm like you, I'm just like, I'm a huge Bible nerd. I remember my older sister read this book and she was like, I could give it to so many of my friends, except like, you're so Christian-y, you know? And I'm like, I know I am so Christian-y. Like there's no way to like not be that for me. And what's been really encouraging, so like the flip side of feeling that grief of not being prepared for the common good is recognizing there's such a wider, richer, larger Christian tradition that is all about the common good. And we get to be just one tiny part of this larger Christian story. And that really upends the narrative of white evangelicalism, which is always about we are the pinnacle of God's work in the world. You know, this is all about colonialism and the conquistadors, that same sort of rhetoric of we are at the top of God's hierarchy. We're meant to be in charge. Of course, we'll use it for good, blah, blah, blah.
We're the missionaries. We're going to go save the world. We are bringing the good news. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's my heritage. And so really just saying like, ugh, I was taught a lot of things that I don't think are right anymore. I'm just so glad I'm just one little fish in this very large pond that really is designed to say God's dream for the world is for everyone to flourish, not just me, but for everyone. And I know that desire doesn't come from me because I am not a good person like that, you know? So I know it comes from God. And that's the encouraging thing. But I know some people have read my book, particularly if they come from a background like me, and just been like, oh, so what? We just like burn it all down? Like, what's next? You know?
Yeah.
And to me, that's really a question that is kind of coming from whiteness. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that too, if people have sort of done the same thing to you, like, okay, fine, everything's terrible. Like, what next? Or do we just end it all? What do you say when people ask?
I think so. Yes. I have also had that experience. Cause I cope with life and with, you know, grappling through things, whatever, by just naming all the things that are wrong. Cause in my mind, that's good news. Like, let's just put it out in the open.
Yeah.
Let's be really honest about what's not working and what's hard. And apparently this is not how everybody functions. I have learned. But not everybody appreciates being told all the things that are wrong at one time. They're like, oh, whoa, 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 like, let's like turn that up slightly. Like, let's just like drip those out one by one. And I'm like, well, no, because it, you know, doesn't do us any good to hide from it. So I think that it is absolutely a way that whiteness functions to just say, well, if this isn't working or if it's wrong, then we just destroy it. There's nothing good here. And the idea that like of correction and accountability, of saying this is wrong and this is my complicity in this, and like the idea of like repentance and then repair, right? That it's not just confession of like, oh, I admit that I am a sinner, or I admit that I did this thing wrong. Please forgive me. But then there's work to repair too, right? Like, you know, almost like if you go back to like a Catholic idea of like penance, right? There's a way that we make this right. And we don't burn it all down. We don't throw our hands up and walk away entirely, but we work to restore and to make it right. Yeah. And that's one thing that, like, you know, you lose the imagination for within white evangelicalism with its emphasis on like conversionism, but also there's not a whole lot of social imagination for that either. Our justice system is,
oh like, yeah,
penalizing, like, well, you made a mistake, so we're going to either like lock you up and throw away the key, or lock you up and remove your rights, or whatever. And so the idea of saying that, like, no, like making things right does look like naming things that are wrong, right? That is naming what is wrong, yeah, is an inherently a hopeful act in my mind, right? Because if you say this is wrong, then that assumes that there's a right.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you with that. And I also, you know, thinking about this sort of genre of lament, right, in the scriptures, you know, and I think the foundation of lament is you tell the truth of the world exactly as it is, and yes, you don't have to hide behind Christian language or language to please God, you know, but you can be like, this sucks, everything sucks, what's going on? And then, you know, that there's an inherent hopefulness in that because you trust that there's a God listening to you.
Right.
But then I was talking about this with somebody and they pointed out that, yeah, as soon as you also tell the truth of the world as it is, you are then implicating all your listeners in, yes, in being a part of restoring that injustice and being a part of working to end that injustice. And I think you and I have very similar personalities here where, again, we see this as a hopeful thing. Like, mm-hmm, let's talk about the systems of our culture and how they've been designed from the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. To oppress some and to elevate others. And as soon as we say that, now we're all implicated in saying, well, that's obviously wrong.
Yep.
Let's make it right. And I do find that inherently hopeful.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want to work together with everybody to, yeah, see the mutual flourishing of all. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're going to need everybody. That's the other thing too, right? Like, we don't just need people who are doing one particular type of work, right? Like, this system was built and established and has continued on for all of these years because you have people in all facets of society with all kinds of different like passions and gifts and abilities and working in different sectors who are helping uphold it in their own way, right? The systems are made of people. Yeah. And so, yeah, the more people we implicate in the truth, then yeah, like I desperately need some people that understand like finance to be implicated in this, because I have no idea what to do with that. Like, I don't numbers, yeah, at all. I letter, right? Like, I do words, I don't do numbers. And so, like, I think it's one of those, it ties into that whole recovering from thinking that you have all the answers or that you're the pinnacle, oh, right? That it's like, oh no, yes, we need everybody. We need everybody.
So
dear listeners, you're all implicated now. Congratulations. You get to bust the American dream with us.
Oh, I love it. We just implicated everyone. I think a great reframe of that too, you know, is, how did Dr. King say it? Like, we're all caught in this mutual,
yeah,
inescapable web of mutuality. And so, mm-hmm, we can view it as a positive thing. Like, we are strengthening the connections that are already there. We truly are, yeah, connected to everyone. We really, mm-hmm, are. And we have to acknowledge that and view it as a joy to be connected instead of viewing it as a burden, which when I start to view it as a burden, that means like I'm 100% in my savior complex land.
Yep.
And I need to get out of that.
Yep. I think more often than finding it a burden, I view it as an unnecessary vulnerability, right? Mm. Like, oh, I don't want to need you. Like, I want to be able to handle this on my own. I want to believe that, mm-hmm, I have the resources within myself because I don't want to burden you, right? That it's like this,
yeah,
weird internal savior complex too, right? Of like, I have everything I need within myself for this, which is also a load of crap.
Yeah.
But I think that's how it plays out for me more is like, oh, I don't want to have to depend on somebody else. I want to be able to just do all this myself because I don't like being vulnerable. It's uncomfortable. But it's needed. We're not called to do it alone.
Yeah, that's such a hallmark of an individualistic culture. And I think I wouldn't even know how individualistic our culture is if I hadn't been in relationship with people from collectivist cultures.
Yeah.
And so that's where most of my neighbors are coming from. And it's just such an incredible, you know, I'm not saying like there's everything positive about that because I'm sure there's downsides, but it really does point to some blind spots that I personally have within me. And I think from what I've gathered from my friends who come from these kinds of cultures, just this idea that like, yeah, you're in need today. I might be in need tomorrow. Like life is very precarious. And so you take care of each other how you can. And some of these, it's just due to necessity. There really is this sense of like, of course we'll help you out when you're not doing well, because this happens to everybody. And this is what we're supposed to do. And I just, I feel like there's such a pride and almost like a prosperity gospel underneath this idea that we really should work hard to be independent and to take care of ourselves. And I've really seen that baptized into Christian language, including like with our finances and, you know, all these things. And I just want to say, I don't have all the right answers, but I'm just saying that is not the overarching message of Jesus, is to be self-sufficient.
Yeah, right? Like the guy that wouldn't go anywhere without at minimum 12 other people was not the one who was like, go it alone, John Wayne style, kingdom of God. Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me of, it was 2 years ago, I think. And one of our neighbors who, ended up in our neighborhood through forced migration. They have an intergenerational household and the grandmother was at home with like six kids. And the next thing I know, all six of these kids are in my house because she had seen me outside with my daughter and just sent all the kids down to me. And then I became the like designated person with the kids that day, which in my white American, formerly evangelical mind, I was like, wait a minute, I didn't sign up for this. But then like later that week, I sent my kid down there and it was just like, okay, well, oh, this is just going to be a new rhythm of like, who's watching the children today? And that's not going to be something we've necessarily even like verbally negotiate. It's just going to be we pay attention to each other.
Yeah.
And we observe. And it makes me think of the, like the way you open the book of like observing the moss and observing the world around you. And like that maybe the, not the whole key, but maybe the first start is just be more aware of what's going on around you and respond to that.
Yeah, I think that has some ramifications for, you know, if you want to be involved in justice work, but I would say just as sort of like being a person in the world, right? That's just something that all my favorite writers and poets, they're always talking about, how can we learn to pay attention? I think it was Simone Weil who says, you know, prayer is the art of paying attention. That's what prayer is. And so for me, I think it was really important for me to start my book about walking around my neighborhood. And I do really weird prayer walks. Like, yes, I try and pay attention, but I also like pray these intense, like anti-gentrification prayers as I march around these like condos that are going up that are going to price out my neighbor. You know what I mean? I'm a mixed bag of
walls
emotions.
Of Jericho or you know, modern farmhouse apartments, both and.
Exactly. So sometimes they're imprecatory prayers and other times I'm like, okay, God, I just pray the people who need housing will find their way into these spaces. Yeah. Anyways. But yeah, trying to pay attention to the good and the bad. It's like you can't shut out one or the other. You have to experience both or else you're not experiencing the fullness of what it means to be human and to be made in the image of God. And, you know, I think if you read the book, it's clear where I tend to put most of my focus, which is on the bad.
Right.
And so my spiritual discipline is learning to look at the moss and learning to look at the flowers. And so I think we probably all come from different backgrounds. If you're already really good at paying attention to the good, then you're probably going to need to go on some walks and pay attention to the inequality, you know, because you'll find it if you walk around your city, you'll find it if you look hard. So yeah, I think it's probably just all of us have a bent towards one or the other and we probably need to do some course correcting.
Yes. Yeah. It makes me think of, I worked for years before I started writing and pastoring as a personal trainer. And like everybody has like a dominant side of their body for the most part of like which side is stronger. Yep. So like I'm right side dominant. Like I'm right handed. But also like my left leg is stronger or my right leg is stronger than my left leg. And so like when I would be working with patients, I worked with a lot of clients who were like cancer survivors or stroke survivors or things like that, right? And so we were doing more medicinally based like exercise programs. And it was like, all right, we're going to do this 10 times on your right side and 15 times on your left, right? That there's, we have to even this out. Otherwise, we're going to continue. If we allow this this disproportionate shift to persist, you're going to end up with an injury, because if you're always favoring your right side, then your left side is more likely to get injured or whatever. And so I think about that in like our spiritual lives, right? That it's like, if my bent is to the, to naming what's wrong, which, you know, mine also is, right? Which is like, let me just lament all day and it would be fantastic. Like, there is so much to be sad about. Yeah. When I was doing more like worship leading, people would be like, you know, you don't have to make every worship service sad by the end, right? Like we could have some like joyous worship. And I was like,
but maybe you did, because you probably grew up in a church like me where it was only joy filled songs. So we all probably have to do this pendulum swing, right?
Right, right.
That's probably where I'm at. But I've like literally never heard a sad worship service. I would like to go to yours.
Oh yes. I could write you so many beautiful sad worship services. But yeah, like I also need to like move toward the good. But I think it's just an invitation for all of us, right? To first become curious about your own life and your own bent, and then do the opposite of that. Like work your non-dominant side. And if you're...
I love that.
If you're a happy person, which I don't think of myself as a sad person. I just don't... I'm not bothered by sad things. And so like if you are always looking for the blessing, I'm using air quotes there. If you're always looking for like, oh, this is the goodness God is bringing forth. Like, all right, well, how about you look at the places that God has not restored yet?
Yeah.
Like, look for those things. And then, yeah, I also need to consider the moss. Or I have houseplants right now for the very first time. I bought houseplants when we started social distancing because I'm an extrovert and I needed other presences, even if they're just plant presences. And it's wonderful to watch the plants grow and just – watch the little miracle of photosynthesis happening on my table in my kitchen. It's great.
I love it. It's as if all of those poets were right about paying attention to the lilies, you know? It's like they were right, because it's totally, I totally have a bunch of plants right now too. Because I got to say, this is just a terrible time to be someone who's obsessed with their neighborhood.
Because
I just, my life.
Or to be a person that's naturally oriented toward like, let's just examine the systems and names the things that are wrong. And I just want to set my head on fire most days, because I'm like,
we can't fix it. We can't fix it. And I literally am not supposed to be like in my neighbor's apartments, you know, drinking chai and talking about it all. So it's just, it's a really hard time. But I think even what you're saying about trying to practice what we're not dominant in, you know, for me, this is really a time of just sort of digging deep into what do I truly believe about the world and God, and God's orientation toward the world, I think, is love, and I think is flourishing. And so I'm just going to trust that when we come out of this time, I'm going to just continue to work for the common good. But yeah, it's just really sucky right now. And my heart goes out to everyone, you know, listening, and, you know, those of us who we can't engage relationally the ways we've become accustomed to. It just sucks.
Yeah. It's so hard. It's so hard. I'm wondering, like, in your navigating, how do I still love my neighbors? How do I love my neighborhood? Well, right now, are there ways that you're finding to engage in different ways? Like, are there ways that your own imagination is being expanded? Or is it really this more like, oh no, like, let's go deep right now. Like, yeah. Can you say more about how you're navigating that?
Yeah, I would say that it's just, I'm in a uniquely sort of like interesting position. So I mostly am friends with people who are first generation immigrant or refugees. A lot of them come from backgrounds where they are, you know, they had limited access to education. So I have my master's in teaching English to speakers of other languages. And so I usually teach free community classes, and I specialize in literacy. So people who like maybe didn't go to school at all.
Yeah.
And I love this group of people. They have a lot of barriers to accessing technology. And so it's really hard to stay like connected during this time. It's probably one of the hardest groups of people to maintain relationship with. And so I've just had to just accept that and do what I can. I mean, I've definitely helped some people out and taking them on errands and stuff, but you know, I am trying to abide by quarantine as much as possible. And yeah, I'm mostly just going on lots of these walks around my neighborhood, praying for people. I am involved in some like gathering and organizing and dividing up of supplies because there's so many real needs, but yeah. As an Enneagram one, it's just making my head explode because none of this is equitable. And there's always that thing in the back of my mind that's like, if I wasn't here running around organizing this, like this wouldn't happen. And that's not right. Mm-hmm. Like the school system should be doing this for everybody. And you know, just like a little example is my daughter, you know, goes to the local school. Mm-hmm. She's in fourth grade. It's when we started going there, I think it was the second lowest rated school in all of Oregon, just mm-hmm. because of test scores and stuff like that.
Right.
But because of, you know, people, it's like 98% low-income families, and people just weren't able to access the internet or get on to online school. So we went 4 weeks without like with nothing, no communication from the school, just no schoolwork, nothing. And now that we are starting, it's like my daughter's doing like 15 minutes a day. And I would say like only a third of her class is actually online doing that.
Yeah.
Little bit of work. You know what I mean? And so I'm really wrestling with like, do I do extra schoolwork with my daughter? Do I pursue all these other things? Like she's super smart and wants to do stuff, but I'm like, this is just going to further the inequality. I don't want her to go back to school next year and be like way more ahead of everybody. It's this fascinating conversation where again, the school is like in some ways being equitable by not doing very much because that's where most kids are. But as a parent, I have to struggle with, oh my gosh, what am I supposed to do? Or what's my responsibility? So I don't think I'm answering your question. I'm just saying all my dilemmas aloud, which, you know.
That's good though, because I think that even that is such an invitation to reframe. And that's, you know, that's a familiar reframe that we've made with our daughter who's in second grade. But trying to think through not just what's best for my kid, which is what we are so encouraged to think about both as Americans. And again, that's what like our faith tradition pushes us to like to focus on the family. If we,
I've heard that phrase before or two.
And so like what's best for you and your kid, right?
Yeah.
And you know, make sure that you look out for you and your family. And so even the question of like in this season, how do I not just think about what's best for my child, but what's best for my child in relation to other children too, right? That like that we are connected even in the choices that we make about how we engage quarantine school. And yeah, and there's not any easy answers or like pat answers or even a singular answer that's right for everybody, I don't think.
Right. And I just, again, I'm grateful that I am forced to ask these questions because I think if I was in a different neighborhood or context or school system, I wouldn't be asking these questions. You know, I see all these people online being like, my kid has so much online school and it's so much work. And I'm like, we are living in an alternate universe. And that's the thing, right? About this time, it's just going to further the inequality that's already baked into the system. And I think that's where I just feel pretty depressed most days. It's like, at this point, kids that were already struggling are going to be that much more behind. And, you know, there's like a huge lack of food access in our neighborhood. Yep. And it's just really scary that, you know, some of my friends that I was like, they're going to be fine. They're stable. It's like, they will come up, like text me and be like, I have no food at my house. And, and that's just already happening. And so things that have been hard for people, like it's just going to get harder. And I hope we can continue the work and the spiritual discipline of staying engaged in how hard it is for people and feeling like the fact that we are responsible to them. And it, again, going back to my daughter, it's like, I don't want her to feel overwhelmed by the world and be filled with despair. You know, if I really, really think through what do I want my daughter to know? I want her to know she's loved by God, right? And out of that desire, I want her to be an active participant in the flourishing of the neighborhood, you know, just like Mr. Rogers would say.
Yes.
And so it's been really interesting. I didn't really know how to talk to her about the food thing, but we have started going like 2 times a week, at least we'll walk to our elementary school, which is closed, but they are offering free lunches to kids there. And she sees all the kids coming to get the food. And we've actually had to have some conversations like, you probably didn't know this, but like everybody at your school gets free lunch and breakfast, but like not all kids get that at all schools. And like, since school's been closed, like some people don't have food at and she's just shocked, you know, she doesn't know really. And it's not like she should know. I really struggle sometimes because I don't want that weight to be on her, but I do want her to understand like this is the world that people live in. And some of her friends have even told her that, you know, like we have to go to the school for lunch because we don't have any food at home. And so, oh my gosh, it's a wild ride, isn't it?
It is definitely a wild ride. I think that so much of this, like underlining all of this, is this cultivating a tolerance for being uncomfortable, right? If we're gonna if we're gonna ask these questions or sit with them or grapple with them, even thinking about, you know, that we both have grown up loving the Bible and being like super duper Christians. I have trophies that demonstrate how good of a Christian I was when I was in elementary and middle school. I don't know if you do or not, but I have some of those, which are stupid. But
do you still have them?
I think they're at my parents' house. I don't have them currently.
Post a picture. My goodness. I got to see these.
At my parents' house in West Virginia, I'm pretty sure. But yeah. But to even stay a Christian after deconstructing or grappling with my faith, right? That there's this like, I am okay with being intensely uncomfortable now. And so I'm wondering, have you developed any sort of like strategies or like, if you had to like try to wrap words around the discipline of being uncomfortable, if people are listening and they're like, well, this sounds good and I'm definitely going to buy DL's book and read it and not throw it across the room because I should try to be uncomfortable. How do we help people create tolerance for discomfort, especially people like us who are dominant culture and have the ability to just be like, I'm uncomfortable. And so I'm just going to like turn this switch off.
That's such a great question. I don't have the answer, but I will say, you know, being a healthy person probably goes a long way towards this. So like you've mentioned, you're an Enneagram one. I'm an Enneagram one. And the reason I like the Enneagram is because it helped give me language for the reality that like the way I process the world is different from the way most people process it. Yeah. And I think up until that point, I'm like, no, everybody has this constant voice telling them they're a piece of shite and they need to try harder, do better, do more. And, and my husband's a therapist and he was like, because I thought I was an Enneagram 4, you know, because I'm like, I'm always up in my feels and blah, blah, blah. And he was like, I really want you to listen to this podcast about Enneagram 1s. I'm like, what? I'm a mess. I'm not tidy. Like, I'm not an Enneagram 1. But it was all about the inner critic. Mm-hmm. And he was like, yeah, I think you really have that huge inner critic. I was like, no, everybody has that voice. He's like, no, they don't. And so my husband is really into attachment therapy. And so he's really into saying like, pay attention to your emotions and the feelings that you have and just sit with them for a moment and see what they're teaching you. And I just had a meeting with like a Jesuit spiritual director who kind of told me the same thing, like God works in our emotions. And so if you feel discomfort or like for me, I experience a lot of shame if I sense that somebody's saying I'm not good.
Yeah.
And that's been such a struggle. And even like, I love writing because it helps me understand what's going on inside my head, but I hate publishing because it's opening yourself up for a lot of people to tell you you're not good. And I get it from all sides of the spectrum. And so, it's really important for me as a person of privilege to be able to be open to criticism. Right. But I don't know how to process being told I'm not good. I go to a place of shame and I just really spiral and it's not helpful. And instead, I think it's important to say like, I'm experiencing this emotion right now. Is it grief? Yeah. Is it shame? Is it fear? Is it blah, blah, blah? And sort of sit with that. And so that is, I think, a part of being curious. We can be curious about our reactions without judging them, but we can't stuff them aside because that's really not going to be helpful for the long run. And one thing that's awesome about social media that I found is like, for me, I get to be sort of not even invited into conversations, but I get to listen and learn to some really intense conversations happening. And if I have some like shame reactions or defensiveness or fear or anything crop up in me, like I can just be quiet and like deal with that on my own without spewing that onto other people. And I think that could be really helpful for a lot of us. So, you know, if people read my book and things do come up, it's like, I think that's a perfect opportunity to just sit with the discomfort, sit with the feelings, try and identify even, you know, where you're feeling it in your body, and be honest about it. Because if I am just like, no, I'm fine. I'll just try harder next time. Like, that doesn't actually help me get to this core need I have to be good. The truth is I am not good, but I'm still loved, and I can be invited into relationship, you know, with people that will journey with me long term and hold me accountable. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of a different framework, because I just want to be perfect, and it's no way to live. Mm-mm. I can't be perfect. I just can't. And so I have to be able to sit with the discomfort. It's not easy, but I am learning to name it, sit with it.
Yeah.
And that's all I know how to start. I don't know if you have other things to say to that.
I think that that's yes. Mm-hmm. Like, all of that rings very true. That's why I love not just social media, but that's why I love to like read broadly.
And
read people that I disagree with, or read people that really challenge me or really push me. And I think the question that I often go to if I'm like reading a book or listening to a podcast or whatever is not just like, oh, I'm uncomfortable with this, but also then to like listen to that discomfort too and be like, okay, but why, and who is writing this or putting this message out there? What's their lens? You know, if I'm reading a trademark white evangelical male and they write something that makes me uncomfortable, I am going to hold that discomfort differently than if I'm reading a queer person of color, right? That it's like, oh, those are probably prompting discomfort in me in different ways.
Yes.
That need to be addressed differently within myself. And so to even be like doing power analysis on my discomfort, sort of.
Oh, that's like, so important.
You know, is this man writing this book about how women shouldn't be preachers? Like, that makes me uncomfortable. But that makes me uncomfortable because I'm being told again that I shouldn't do what I do. Yes. And that sucks. And so, like, I'm not going to sit with that discomfort as long or in the same way as I would somebody pointing out my privilege as a white person, or as a or as an able-bodied person, or as a straight person, or, you know, all of those things. And so I think not just learning to sit with the discomfort and ask myself, like, ooh, like, why am I feeling this? But also, like, who is the messenger of that? And then viewing it as an invitation and not as a, you don't get to play, right?
Yeah.
Like a, okay, do your work, right? Like you have to do your work, you know, lace up your tennis shoes before you come run in the field with us. But like, but we're not telling you, you can't come. Just don't come and be like, oh, I wore my jelly sandals and now I have blisters and I can't. It's like, well, no, we told you how to come. Like,
you have amazing metaphors.
It's really just the first thing that comes to my brain.
Running with jelly sandals.
But it is the worst feeling. We grew up in the same era. Like, running in jellies was a horrible idea.
I never got jellies. I think I was too homeschooled. No. I don't know.
I had weird homeschool boundaries in some way. In some ways, I was very, very homeschooled. And in other ways, I was not. But anyway.
They just make me feel like they would make your feet sweaty.
They're very sweaty. They give you phenomenal blisters, like blisters like you would not even conceive of. Like, if there are platonic forms of blisters, jelly blisters are like the highest form of blister.
Wow.
We digress. I think I would love to, as we kind of wind conversation down today, I would love for you to tell listeners where they can find your work other than your book. And that actually fits. We're like talking about like 90s and like jelly sandals, and your podcast is just the most wonderful conglomeration of like weird 90s Christian culture and naming everything that is wrong. I love it so much.
This is so funny to me. I still can't believe that anybody listens to our podcast, because my husband and I have been doing this podcast called The Prophetic Imagination Station for like three years. I hope it's not four. That's so long. We just sit in our closet and talk about like Adventures in Odyssey episodes to each other. And that's all we do. And it's wild. This season, though, we did do something a little different where we're talking about Frank Peretti and his book, This Present Darkness. We got to interview some really amazing people. But yes, I'm obsessed with evangelical artifacts of the 80s and 90s and telling the truth about them. My husband's more of like the Uber fan, and he's a therapist, so he's a good counterpoint to me and my intensity. But we're having a lot of fun, and we're going to be like doing some really fun stuff coming up. So yeah, that's my weird podcast at the Prophetic Imagination Station. And then yeah, you guys, I have a ton of excerpts of the book out right now if people want to find them. You can go to my website, dlmayfield.com, and sign up for my newsletter where I kind of put all that stuff together. I'm on Twitter. That's where you are a lot. And I'm spicy. So people can follow me there, DL Mayfield. Yeah.
And I'll put links to all of that in the show notes. And I desperately want everybody to go subscribe to your podcast because it is just such a source of joy. I listen to it often. Well, not right now because I'm not commuting anymore. But when I was commuting to seminary, I would listen to it like the whole way back from Chicago. So like an hour and a half drive back because it was just such a wonderful, like post class, just like good fun, which I know I have a weird definition of fun. I'm like, oh yes, please tell me all the things that were wrong with my childhood favorite things. This is so great. But that's
okay,
my
this
life.
Is cracking me up. I love it. I love it.
It's yes. And so I listened to so many hours of Adventures in Odyssey growing up, and I just it just is such a great source of joy. And so I want people to listen to that, especially if you grew up listening to a lot of Adventures in Odyssey or reading all of the, I don't think I read This Present Darkness. I read all of Frank Peretti's like children's books, which is a weird sentence in and of itself, but like the Cooper Kid.
Oh yeah.
Yes. I read like all of those multiple times.
Yeah, we did. We did an episode for our patrons on The Door in the Dragon's Throat, which is one of his kids' ones. It does not hold up well. I mean, I hate to tell you that, but
I'm shocked. I am stunned. All of those books definitely would age great.
Oh.
Not at all. Oh. Anyway, I am so glad to have had a chance to talk with you today. And yeah, I hope that everybody checks out the links in the show notes, pick up a copy of The Myth of the American Dream, Reflections on Affluence, Autonomy, Safety, and Power. Order it through one of your local bookstores using bookshop.org, or, you know, buy it on Amazon because we can do that.
It's tumultuous times. Do what you got to do, I guess.
Do what you got to do to get a book. Is there an ebook or an audiobook too, or just
there the... is. It's my first ever audiobook.
Oh, cool.
But I didn't get to do it. Just FYI. Yeah.
All right.
But, you know, cool. Yeah.
Well, if you're disappointed because you loved listening to Danielle talk today, then sorry, but if you were like, oh, I'd love to hear her book, but I don't want to hear her read it, then
you'll probably be happy it's a professional and not me just laughing high-pitched all the time.
Thanks so much for tuning in for another episode of The Podluck. Go ahead and make sure that you are subscribed so that you don't miss an episode. We will be talking later this week more about loving our neighbors and what that looks like in this particular era, especially with regard to what are some of the barriers that people are facing who are usually on the margins of our society. And right now, how is that just exacerbated? And so we will be kind of joining that conversation in a different way. Later this week, we'll be talking with Beth Watkins on that front. So make sure you hit subscribe so that you do not miss that episode or any other episodes. If you enjoyed this episode or others, or if you want to share it on social media, use @PodluckPodcast on Twitter or @ThePodluckPodcast on Instagram. As always, I've been your host, Megan Westra. Thanks so much for tuning in. And yeah, join us next.